Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabartia, and yes, it is Friday, so let's take a look at the week that was. And our fine panelists for our week in review today, Dante Ramos. He is an op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe and editor of the Globe's Sunday Ideas section. Dante, it's good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Also with us, John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and senior analyst for WBUR and the scribe of multiple very fine blogs, which you should read. John, it's good to have you back.
Thank you,
Meghna.
Well. I see the checks are clearing.
Exactly. I can go buy myself a cup of coffee now.
Excellent.
All right. Well, gentlemen, first of all, since DACA is in the news, and we just had a conversation before the break about it. I was wondering if I could get your quick takes. I mean, Dante, what do you make of the fact that the president may rescind this program that could have an impact on 8,000 young people here in Massachusetts?
I think his stance on this is something that is very important to the people who he thinks elected him. It's unfortunate that things have reached this point because, as we just heard, this is the result of Congress not, over the course of a decade or more,
right,
not doing anything to deal with a sort of anomalous situation, which is having a large number of unauthorized immigrants in the country. And while while all of that deliberation has gone on and nothing has come out of it, you have a student who was brought here at age 9 from another country and has lived the last decade under a cloud of uncertainty. And I think it's unfortunate that the human toll of that isn't first on the minds of all of the people making this decision.
John?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one more example of Donald Trump as America's first Cubist president. I mean, he's on every side of every issue. And, he can agonize all he wants and play Hamlet all he wants about this. But, he should really be out lobbying Congress to pass legislation.
Yeah.
That would be the solution.
I wonder if that's what's going on here, right? He's going to satisfy his base by rescinding the program, but he's kind of signaling under the table, Congress, you can at least get this done, if not comprehensive immigration reform, no, but this one thing, and maybe he'd sign that legislation.
It's possible. I mean, you also look, there's the human cost that Dante mentions, no question, but there's also a financial cost. I mean, this will cost a lot of money to the U.S. economy. The one estimate is $433 billion lost over 10 years if the DACA dreamers are sent out of the country. So, I mean, there are real financial implications as well as human implications in this, and I'm not sure that people have really paid much attention to those either.
I'd throw in the moral implications as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll see what the president decides to do as and when he announces his decision on DACA. Let's move on to the biggest story by far of the week, and that is Hurricane Harvey, then Tropical Storm Harvey, now just Harvey, but it's the catastrophe it has wrought in Texas. We have some tape here of Texans. This is Lily Galindo. She's from Dickinson, Texas, about 40 minutes outside of Houston. She told the Associated Press about the damage done to her house.
I'm honestly at a loss for words. I just know I have work to do, and I'm a single mom with 3 girls. So, to see our life literally float away, in a sense, and just being drowned, I got to swallow it and keep going.
Yeah. And here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He spoke this morning on ABC.
This is going to be a massive, massive cleanup process. It's going to be far larger in scope than Katrina was because the geographic area covered was far larger. This is not going to be a short-term project. This is going to be a multi-year project for Texas to be able to dig out of this catastrophe.
Dante, let's start with you. You were in New Orleans, living and working there during Katrina, so you've had firsthand experience about the devastation these kind of storms can bring. I mean, what are your thoughts when you see what's happening in Houston?
I think what the governor of Texas just said is exactly right. If you're watching these things from a distance on television, it's a news story. You see 1 week, 2 weeks of coverage, and then the next thing happens, and the attention of the world moves on once the acute crisis is over. And the thing to understand about having 4 feet of water in houses or larger amounts of water in houses is that's a lot of drywall to be taken out. That's a lot of supplies of things that people would normally consume, food, clothing, just stuff that gets hauled out on the curb. It's an extraordinarily difficult process. And, the sheer number of homes, it's staggering. You know, I don't think that the TV camera is quite, you'll see an individual house, but when you see block after block after block, or square mile in this case, after square mile of inundation, it's hard to really express that through a television camera.
You know, so Houston is America's, what, fourth largest city, something like that? So massive in scope and scale. But if there's, maybe it's too early to say, you know, is there good news here? But I want to find a little bit of optimism here, John, because I think, unlike with Katrina, where we saw immediate failures of response and government in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, we haven't seen that in Houston, which is a little ray of sunshine here.
It certainly is. And there's a couple of areas where Houston is very different from Katrina. One of them, it's much bigger, and it has an economy that is actually reasonably solid and reasonably robust. So that's going to be a little bit easier to come back on from than Katrina. New Orleans has an economy that's based on tourism. So almost by definition, a lot of the economic rebound was denied to them because it just wasn't going to happen. You know, I think the other thing is we have seen a lot of people come together here as opposed to Katrina. And one thing that seemed to happen in Katrina, and Dante maybe can speak to this more fully, is there was a racial component to the reaction to Katrina that we don't see here. And I think that that's encouraging as well. The last thing I'll say is anybody who says this is going to be a short-term turnaround and recovery is the president of the United States, because that's what he went down and told them. And I think that's a real disservice to people. I think the governor and the mayor of Houston are both telling the truth and giving them realistic views.
Well, we have a little bit of tape here from the president. This is him from Wednesday. After he was in Texas, he went to Missouri. And here's what he said.
To the people of Houston and across Texas and Louisiana, we are here with you today. We are with you tomorrow, and we will be with you every single day after to restore, recover, and rebuild.
I mean, Dante, you have written about this, right? I mean, you wrote this week that there will be second-guessing armchair experts, you know, criticizing the response to this disaster. But this could have happened anywhere to anyone, and your point is that maybe we shouldn't be so critical.
Well, I think that a lot of different areas have risk factors. You know, obviously, if you're on the Gulf Coast, you're located on warm water, you're likely to get more intense hurricanes. On the other hand, I'm not sure until about 5 years ago, many of us would have thought that the second most expensive hurricane in the United States would have been in New York and New Jersey.
Right.
You know, that was a storm surge of event rather than a rain event. It's also, by the way, the type of event that Boston would be more susceptible to. So, you know, there are risk scenarios that the federal government has that San Francisco, you know, a big earthquake on the West Coast, hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, terrorist attacks on the East Coast. But as Hurricane Sandy showed us, there's also the possibility of a very destructive hurricane in a northerly area. So, I think people should count their blessings and reserve a measure of judgment.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Sandy because, you know, as much as I wanted to keep politics out of this, it's impossible, right? Because one of the sub-stories that emerged over the week was that, you know, most of the Republican members of the Texas congressional delegation voted against the Sandy recovery bill. And of course, now we hope that nobody votes against a recovery bill for Texas. So, I mean, it's like, you need the federal government when the disaster's in your own backyard.
Right. And you know, I think Representative Peter King from New York said it the best. He said, you know, just because you guys didn't vote to send help to us, that doesn't mean we're not going to vote to send help to you. And I think he looked directly at the Texas delegation. Actually, the Louisiana delegation was far more generous when Superstorm Sandy hit in terms of voting for disaster relief. So I think that this is going to happen. I mean, there's a lot of hypocrisy on the Republican side in that back then, then they wanted all that money offset by cuts. Now they don't want all that money offset by cuts. So I think that, you know, because it's in their backyard, they have a different set of principles now. But I don't think that it's going to get in the way. I don't think there's going to be a revenge factor in Congress that's going to get in the way of relief for Houston.
Dante, your thoughts on that?
I agree completely. I think One thing that the generosity of the Louisiana delegation around Sandy shows is that once this kind of thing has happened to you, you see it through a somewhat different lens. And it was awfully easy for more ideologically minded members of the Republican congressional delegation to, you know, say, no, we're not, we're going to deny New York and New Jersey money. But it's hard to do that when that's your own constituents. And as a matter of human decency, you shouldn't deny them.
Yeah.
Can I just add one quick thing? This calls for some kind of reform of flood insurance, because the vast majority of people, and there are 400,000 homes that were significantly damaged, that's by one estimate, the vast majority of them have no flood insurance at all. And I think that the system has to be looked at, because private insurance companies don't offer it. The federal government offers limited, and there's a move afoot in Congress to make it even more expensive.
Right.
So all the people, you know, anybody who can afford it now, maybe they can't afford it down the road. So I think that this is really a call for someone to look at this system and try to reform it in some way.
And we can only expect that this is going to happen, perhaps not a 60-inch rain event, but, you know, major storms and hurricanes, like you were saying earlier, Dante, you know, in multiple places in the United States with climate change, with coastal communities growing the way they have.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with John's point, too, about flood insurance. It's a really complicated problem, but that said, there are a lot of people along the coast who do not now have flood insurance who probably should have flood insurance. A lot of the places that were inundated in Houston were outside of any recognized floodplain.
Right.
And I think that you know, maybe one way to bring more money into the system is to have more people realize, hey, that maybe this is something we need.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to a little bit of more tape here of Voices from Houston. This is Robert Picard. He is from the Massachusetts chapter of the American Red Cross. He is helping out in Houston. He spoke with us yesterday.
In the first few weeks or month of disaster, the public is very generous. And then after a while, they stop, they forget, or something else supplants it in the news, because another disaster comes along, even if it's not at the same scale. And this is going to be months for basic recovery. And for the city to recover its full economic base will be years.
So he's taking the very long view there based on what he's seeing in Houston. But I want to bring it back here to the United States, to Boston, just for we are the hub, I guess, for a moment here, because Mayor Marty Walsh, he was on Boston Herald Radio on Wednesday. He was asked about, you know, what would happen if a storm like Harvey hit home here.
If Harvey hit Boston Harbor, we're wiped out as a city. I mean, there's not much. We can't prevent it today.
Right.
What we can do is evacuate, make sure that people get out of their homes, make sure that we have contingency plans for people that get out of their homes. Make sure that we have plans for rebuilding. Make sure that we don't have looting that's going on in Houston right now, and make sure that we clamp down on public safety in the community. That's all we could do right now.
John, let me turn to you on this, because this is a tough one for Boston. Because on the one hand, again, a 60-inch rain event, hopefully we won't see that in 500 years. But they did just have one in Houston. On the other hand, the city's getting built up at record pace. We got to have some sort of comprehensive, and we do, but is it enough, a comprehensive plan to be resilient in the face of these kind of events?
No, I don't think it's enough. I think it's really unlikely that a Harvey-like event would happen in Boston. You know, for it to linger for 5 days, that's just not how the weather works here, really. Usually, you know, it comes through with a bang, and then it's gone. No city could handle 50 inches of rain over 5 days. But I think that there are things that Boston should be looking to do, and the big challenge is not to figure out what to do, it's to figure out how to convince people to pay for it, because that's one of the problems down in Houston. I mean, they've had three major floods over the past 3 years, and you know, each one of them has indicated that, you know, we should be doing something about this, but the will's not there, the money's not there, and I think that's the biggest issue of all. You could go to Amsterdam and look at what they're doing, and they spend a lot of money there. We could spend a lot of money here, but for people to actually accept the fact that that's what's needed, not talk, not evacuation plans, but actually money spent, that's a really hard thing to do.
Dante?
I concur absolutely. You know, the 50-inch rainstorm is not the kind of – is probably very unlikely here. But storm surge, you know, the wall of water pushed into the harbor, and harbors tend to narrow. So it's a triangular area. It gets higher the farther, you know, the farther into the harbor you get. That's the kind of thing that we should worry about. Houston is actually on relatively high ground, by the way, relative to some place like Galveston or New Orleans. But you know, if you stepped back, you could say that, oh, in Boston, in the Back Bay, it's called the Back Bay, there are $800,000 basement apartments built on former title flats. And you could step back if you were a, you know, an uncharitable member of the Texas congressional delegation circa 2040 and say, oh, my God, why did they spend so much money on basement apartments? That's ridiculous. But we need to be thinking about grander solutions to these issues. You know, there have been discussions about some kind of larger hurricane barrier across the harbor. The environmental issues are complicated. The cost is enormous, but it's something that needs to be discussed.
This is one of those fundamental challenges in terms of like our human and community capacity to think about the value that we get out of spending money now to be protected versus the potential costs in the future of not doing so. It's a tough sell, especially when the dollar figures are as high as they are. All right. So before we wrap up for today, there is another story that I wanted to just touch on really quickly. And that's the fact that Governor Charlie Baker has proposed new legislation. And it's interesting because this would target drug dealers and it would create a new manslaughter charge for drug dealers where the drug sale leads to a user's death. And it would also create a mandatory minimum sentence for 5 years for anyone caught selling any drugs, not just opiates. And these are drugs that would lead to someone's death. The governor spoke about the proposal on Wednesday.
What I want is a statute that will basically say that if you knowingly sell somebody carfentanil, fentanyl, a mix of those two with something else, a certain kind of dose of heroin, whatever it happens to be, if they die, that we can charge you with manslaughter.
That's a really interesting proposal here. Dante, what's your thought on that?
Mandatory minimums sentences are something that was a crime-fighting tool of the 90s and in most ways are being rolled back because states and the federal government to some degree have found that they're inflexible. I suspect that this law in practice would have a similar effect. I understand from a moral perspective wanting someone who, you know, knowingly, as the governor put it, put carfentanil or fentanyl in, sold that to someone, that the seller would be punished. I think these things in practice tend not to be that neatly. And did the dealer who's selling to feed a habit, did that person know that what exactly they were selling?
Yeah.
The history of drug prosecutions has been that they tend to they're trying to pick up people who are fairly low in the food chain, and where the carfentanil enters the supply of opiates that are being sold to people on the street, I have no idea. But it, you worry about not getting the people who are truly responsible.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, John. Governor Baker has talked about walking up the ladder and going after the big dealers as well as the small dealers. But I think Dante's right. In practice, it doesn't happen all that much. Another issue that that some people have brought up is essentially discouraging people from calling 911 because you think you may be subject to this law if there's an overdose occurring, and so you don't basically want to get involved in that, and that could lead to more opioid deaths. I mean, they're 900 and something already this year, opioid deaths in Massachusetts. There were 2,000 last year. So I think that anything that discourages people from addressing the problem and from acting when someone is in danger of overdosing is problematic. I think in theory, this is probably a good idea. I think in practice, that's where it's going to be problematic because I think that it's in a way criminalizing opioid addiction to some degree.
Yeah, but I can imagine on the other hand, many people look at the governor's proposals and say it's exactly the right thing to do because what it's discouraging is people selling some of these drugs that could lead to these overdoses. But we'll talk about it more next week as we get a better sense of as to what the proposal is. Okay, can we do a lightning round here with our hubbubs? Because we got 60 seconds to get them all in there. So Dante, your hubbub.
Okay, well, it's the most wonderful time of the year for people who like free furniture and also like moving. It's Alston Christmas. Data science now allows you to see a heat map of where the moving van permits have been issued. Unfortunately, data science has not solved the worst design glitch in Boston, which is that you can get onto Storrow Drive in a truck that is taller than you can drive along Storrow Drive because of the overpasses.
Alston Christmas,
talking
everybody.
About structural problems, right?
All right, John, you got 20 seconds.
Very quickly, out at the Berkshire Museum, there's a big rumpus over selling off 40 artworks, two of them paintings by Norman Rockwell. A group came along this week and offered $1 million to the museum to just put the sale on hold. They won't. Everything goes on sale at Sotheby's this fall.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. Well, mine had to do with Samsung. I'm going to hold it until next week. Just let's say when Samsung's phones don't blow up in your face, their advertising campaigns might do just that. John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University, and Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for The Globe. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.